Hi folks, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to the latest podcast from the Banter team. One of the most fascinating Banter at Bloom discussions last year involved lessons in looking and listening. We're joined here by Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland and Richard Collins from the RT Radio 1 Mooney Goes Wild team to talk about a huge growth and interest in birdwatching, and they've also got lots of advice to newcomers in the twitching game.
Hi folks, welcome along to the second day of Banter here at Bloom. Don't worry, the tent will fill up as soon as we start talking. We found out yesterday the tent fills up. And also I've been told by Evelyn Cusack, who did Banter yesterday, that there's a really serious cloud full of rain coming from that direction. So the tent will fill in about 10 minutes' time. We start today with a panel called Watch the Sky. And basically it's about birdwatching. And basically, I suppose I know very little about birdwatching, except that I hear what's going on in my garden. So I decided to enlist the help of two esteemed gentlemen here. On this side, in the beige top, we have got Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland. And here, this gentleman here is Richard Collins from RT Radio 1's Mooney Goes Wild team and from many other places as well. Please give him a round of applause.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay. Let's start, gentlemen, with a general question. What drew you to birdwatching in the first place, Niall?
Well, I started, would you believe, before I can even really remember. I started birdwatching when I was about 2 years old, so my mother tells me. Like a lot of kids, she used to take me to feed the ducks in the park. She used to go to St. Stephen's Green. And I didn't just like to feed them, I apparently became obsessed with them. I used to walk around after the ducks. I used to try to have conversations with these ducks. And just since then, I really haven't known a time when I haven't been fascinated with birds. I suppose my earliest conscious memory of looking for birds was when I was around four, I would guess, with the robins in the garden. And my uncle had a robin that came down to my hand to take food from my hand, and it was just a magical moment for me. It would stay with me the rest of my life. And from then, I was just absolutely hooked. And I have to say, it's given me so much in my life. Since then, I've travelled to 6 continents, working on conservation projects, watching birds, and helping to protect them. And it's just been amazing. It's really changed my life. It was an absolutely brilliant thing to do.
Okay. And was your epiphany something similar as well, Richard?
No, I was a bold boy, Jim. A very bold boy indeed. When boys are small, they collect things, do you see? And I used to collect various things, stamps and God knows what, railway timetables and all kinds of things. But one of the fads that developed when I was small was collecting birds' eggs. And I used to collect birds' eggs. What I would do, I wouldn't raid a nest. I would go along with a spoon. I had some conservation interest even in those days. I would go along and remove an egg with the spoon, put two holes in it, one at each end, and blow out the contents. And I built up quite... I would only take one egg, an egg of that species, yeah. Ever. And I built up a big collection from that, but I didn't know much about what the birds looked like. I just knew that that was a dunnock, and that was a magpie, and that was something else. And from that grew, I eventually purchased the Observer's Book of Birds, which is probably still around for all I know. And of course, those days you didn't have fancy binoculars. There were then cheap Japanese binoculars came on sale about 1960-ish or thereabouts, and I acquired a pair of those. And the collecting spread to finding out, what about these birds that produce these lovely eggs? What's their life like?
Yeah.
And how many different kinds of these can I see? So it's from there I spread on into bird watching full time. I would never touch an egg now, you can be sure of that.
I bet you wouldn't. It's interesting, like, you know, the change in your mindset then. I mean, at what stage did you realise, was it from reading those Observer bird books, or was it from talking to other people, that what you were doing as a truant, as a kind of a juvenile delinquent was wrong?
Well, that came from going to the library, the Limerick County Library, looking for birds. See, the problem if you want to find, I remember finding a ring ousel's nest up in the Knockmealdown Mountains. Now, a ring ousel is a mountain blackbird, very scarce, even scarcer now. Now, how do you find a ring ousel's nest sort of thing? So I used to borrow books about 5 very learned people in England writing about how to find nests and things of this kind. And the attitude of these people when you read the books was all towards conservation. They advised very careful, don't create a track into the nest, don't disturb the local vegetation, make sure the fox when he comes along doesn't know you have been there. So yeah. From this, a conservation attitude pervaded those books even then, back in the 1950s. That was there, and that value system came in through that. So gradually I began to realise this is about protection, it's not about collecting, shall we say.
Yeah. I mean, one of the quotes I came across a while back about bird watching is a really interesting quote. It's a guy called Anthony McGeehan, and he was kind of saying about that, like, bird watching was more like appreciating art than studying science. Would you kind of concur with that?
I would. I think it's where the two actually come together, because some people get into birds, or most people, I suppose, because they're beautiful, because they're fascinating. I think the fact that they can fly is something that just we get absorbed with. But I think a lot of people then come to a realization that these birds do need protection, and that we don't know a lot about many of their aspects of their lives. I think that still migration is just an amazing mystery. Something that just blows my mind is that the bird, the house martin, such a common bird around our houses, builds those mud nests under the eaves. We still don't know where it goes for the winter. We know it leaves Ireland, presumably goes somewhere in Africa, but the wintering grounds have never been found. And there's always new scientific discoveries there. I think that they say about ornithology, which is the science of studying birds, that it's the area where the amateur actually has a bigger role to play than the professional, because the amateurs are out there with the passion, they're out observing the birds. And we're finding now through what we call citizen science, people taking part in not as professional scientists, but just submitting their observations, this is having a huge role to play in our understanding of things like climate change, its effect on birds, nature reserves, and what the areas that need to be protected. So it's absolutely vital. So I think it does. It combines both art and science in a very nice way.
Yeah.
There was a lecture given back in 1959, I think it was, by C.P. Snow in Britain, in London. Now, C.P. Snow was a very interesting man. He straddled the Great Divide. He was a prominent scientist, a very distinguished scientist, and he also wrote novels. Yeah. And he talked about the two cultures. Now, here at Bloom, it strikes me as one of those great meeting points of two cultures. The science behind plant growing comes into play, and so does the aesthetics from the other side. So the gardener, in a sense, is marrying the two cultures. Now, so is the bird watcher, in a sense. Birds are beautiful creatures. Art is full of illustrations of them. Birdsong-influenced musicians. Art and science come together in the bird world, in a sense. And going out bird watching, you're hunting. That's what you're doing. You're hunting the birds, but you're not killing them. You have to outfox them, outmaneuver them, get to see them. Nowadays, get to photograph them. So on the one hand, you're driven by the aesthetic, by the desire to embrace these birds. At the other hand, on the other side, you're using scientific knowledge to do so. So the two cultures, in a funny kind of way, come together both in gardening and bird watching, it seems to me.
I'm curious as well about something that, like, you know, that Niall kind of said there about the I suppose the relationship between the amateur and the professional when it comes to bird watching, when it comes to, like, me, I suppose the greater impact on science and ecology as well. I mean, over the years, obviously there's been changes in terms of the habitat, in terms of, that's also had an effect in terms of the species that are here in Ireland. Have you noticed kind of like other kind of birds that you would have seen in your younger days, both of you, that, like, no longer here? Or is there a case of, like, mean that the migratory habits and patterns have changed hugely?
Absolutely, we're seeing massive changes, and that's something that's gone on through all, I suppose, recorded ornithology or recorded birdwatching history. But we're seeing those changes increasing. So we're losing some species and we're gaining some species. So an example of a species that we've gained recently would be the little egret. This is an all-white bird, a member of the heron family. You often see them around estuaries and around rivers. When I started birdwatching, so I remember in the early 1980s going birdwatching, you would never see this bird. I saw my first one ever in Booterstown Marsh in the very early 90s. People travelled from all over Ireland to see this bird in the marsh. Now it doesn't even get a second glance from bird watchers. This is basically an African and Mediterranean species that has moved northwards and now has colonised Ireland. Started breeding around Youghal and the Cork-Waterford border in 1997 and has spread around the country since then. Suspicion is that climate change has played a role in that. At the same time, we've seen birds disappear. So when I was a kid, I remember corncrakes, while not being common, they were still quite widespread. You could still find them around much of Ireland. My grandmother, who grew up just beside this park here, she tells me, you know, back in the 1920s and 1930s, there were corncrakes all through the Phoenix Park. Nowadays, even just in the course of my life, I've seen that bird just disappear. It's wiped out from most of its strongholds, just clinging on in some of the islands in the west, some parts of mainland Mayo, areas like that. The big driver there has been changes in habitat. It's been intensification of agriculture. It's been just whole spread things like summer flooding in the Shannon Callows. That's caused mainly by climate change, man-made actions as well affecting that. Seeing big, big changes. One very positive change, I suppose, that we've seen, and you may even see it around Bloom today, is the return of birds of prey to our skies, and that's something I think we should really welcome. There's now a pair of buzzards nesting in the Phoenix Park, and we see them often flying right over the banter tent where we are now. Go back even 10 years ago, that would have been unthinkable. And now this is a bird that I see all the time when driving along the M50. It's a big bird of prey. It looks a bit like a small eagle. I often see them sitting on the lampposts. They're starting to come back. Persecution is disappearing. It's still a problem with birds of prey, but it's, we're heading in the right direction. So there have been many changes, some good, some bad, I would say.
What about you, Richard? Agree with that?
Can I perform an experiment?
Yeah, please do.
This is the experiment. Did anyone ever hear a bird singing like that? The jangling of a bunch of keys.
I did.
Now, when I was much younger, we used to go to the Mullet Peninsula in County Mayo to see a little bird called the corn bunting. I saw one recently, that's what puts it into my head, but that was in Poland. Now, this little bird was very common on the mullet, and you could go along and you could hear the jangling of a bunch of keys song that this little bird had. It was quite a big, for a little bird in a sense, it's a big little bird, it's bigger than a greenfinch, a brown thing, but it had this lovely jangling song. Now, that bird is extinct totally in Ireland now. So when you talk about loss, that is the one that immediately comes to mind for me. It's a great pity that this bird is gone. Elsewhere, there are similar trends occurring now. The nightingale, the famous great singer, is disappearing from the south of England. Possibly these things, they're very difficult to pin down, just what's going on, but climate change is... Oh, I'm not speaking into the microphone. Isn't it terrible? Am I awful?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Very good. Yep. So where were we?
You were basically talking about some birds have disappeared completely. You're talking about the bird with the sound of the jangling keys who's kind of moved to Poland.
Oh, yes, the little corn bird. No, he hasn't moved to Poland. He's always been in Poland and he's in France, but he has disappeared from our part of the world due to our neglect, I suppose. We don't farm the way we used long ago. And the climate is changing and so on and so forth. But it's one that comes to mind when you ask about losses and gains, shall we say.
Yeah. It's curious what you say as well, Richard, though, that you can still find that bird and some other species in other parts of the world. And it's almost like, when people think about, I suppose, globalization, they often think that what's happening here in Ireland is reflected elsewhere. But obviously, from what you're saying, the changes that are going on in the landscape and hedgerows here, maybe they're a lot more, series are a lot more advanced than they are elsewhere.
Yes, that's true. I was in Poland, as I say, 2 weeks ago, and the cuckoos were everywhere, and so were corncrakes. And I actually managed to see corncrakes, which is very unusual. You have to try very hard, but you can see them if you try hard enough. So the things that were, which we regard as about to expire completely, are fairly common elsewhere. It's not always true. There are birds in some parts of the world on the verge of extinction, a great many, in fact. But the ones we are particularly worried about are not necessarily in decline elsewhere.
I certainly know that it's a very good point, Richard. I know that the corncrake is a good example of this because in Poland and in places like Belarus, European Russia, the corncrake is actually still a common bird. So we think of the corncrake as a rarity here, but in European terms, there's millions of them. But they're still living in traditionally farmed areas. And we know that the agricultural intensification in Ireland that happened since the 1950s, that bird just could not cope with that change and just vanished overnight. And as these countries now, which of course many of them members now of the European Union, they're modernising, we know too that if the same patterns are followed, those birds that are now abundant will disappear overnight. We also know that Ireland, of course, if you look at our geographic position, it means that where we are on the edge of Europe, it's a great place for bird watching because we're on the migratory pathways of many species coming down from the Arctic, heading down to Africa, coming across from North America. But also we're the edge of the world for many of these birds. So those corn buntings that we lost from Ireland, they were the westernmost corn buntings on the planet. Those corncrakes that now still nest on the Mullet Peninsula on Tory Island, they're the westernmost corncrakes on planet Earth. And we often find that when species start to get in trouble and when climate change plays a role, things start to move back from the margins. So the corn bunting that Richard mentioned, which was once the sound of the Irish countryside, if you went back 100 years ago, this bird would have been everywhere in Ireland, just would have been the sound of summer. Nowadays, to people in the Extremadura region of Spain, just near the Portuguese border, it's the most common bird there too. It's the sound of summer in that part of Spain. But again, for how much longer? We know that these birds can't cope with the kind of changes and the speed of the changes that we humans are inflicting on them. So when I talk about bird watching, and obviously I work for Birdwatch Ireland, and we want people to get out there and look at these birds, we also want people to realise what a special treasure they have in front of them and not to take them for granted because they're not here forever.
Yeah, that brings me to kind of I suppose something else. You're talking there about a place like Poland, Spain, Portugal, the Mullet Peninsula, let's kind of turn to, like, I mean, a lot of people that hear Bloom and their back gardens, what they can hear in their back gardens. Like a colleague of mine in the Irish Times, Rosita Boland, wrote a piece last year about this bird song app she'd found, and she bought it, and she couldn't get over the amount of birds she was hearing in her back garden. And the interest from readers in this was immense. So, I mean, people are quite curious about what's going on in their back gardens. So let's just take an ordinary, I suppose, suburban or kind of like a country garden around Ireland. What are the kind of like birds that are there newer birds who've moved in? Are there certain birds that people wouldn't have heard maybe 20, 30 years ago who they can now hear in their garden?
Well, there's certainly been changes in gardens over the time. I think that the core garden birds that we all have in our gardens, basically, birds like robins, blackbirds, wrens, species like that, they've remained constant in our gardens. But we are finding now that with more and more people feeding birds, and that's something we hear all the time in Birdwatch Ireland, people are passionate about this, this is attracting a wider range of species into gardens as they're learning that food can be found there. So one of the big changes in that regard is a bird I'm very fond of called the blackcap. And the blackcap is a warbler. It's a bird that's a migrant to Ireland, and if you look at any bird books, they even go back written maybe 15 or 20 years ago, the blackcap is strictly a summer visitor to Ireland. Now, they started to spend the winter in people's gardens too, and that seems to be purely because there's a source of food there that can sustain them. But interestingly, we found out that the blackcaps that spend the winter in Irish gardens, they're not the same ones that spend the summer around our gardens and around our parks. It's a different population. Our breeding blackcaps, they still migrate to the Mediterranean as they always have done. The birds that we get in the winter, it seems they come from Central Europe. It could have even been the very ones that Richard must have been hearing singing in Poland recently. Some genetic quirk or some mutation caused a small percentage of that population to migrate the wrong direction. Instead of heading south to Africa, they went more northwest to Ireland and to Britain. That would, for many birds, be a death sentence, but they discovered gardens and the food that was put out for them. This then meant that they could survive the winter, and not just survive, but thrive, head back to Germany and Poland, get back a bit earlier in fitter condition, therefore get the best nesting territories, have more offspring, pass that mutant gene on to the next generation. They would follow the same migratory path, and so that more and more would come to Ireland each year. That's evolution happening in right front of our eyes, and we only find out about this because of people observing them in their gardens. So I think the blackcap, for me, is a good symbol.
Richard? Yes, I catch the odd blackcap in my garden, I must say, and I have a mist net in the garden. The garden is quite small. It's about the size of this area here, which, of course, is only, 15, 20 meters by 20 meters, something like that. And in that, on a typical day, I can catch a dozen different kinds of birds per accidents. You know, some days you don't catch one or two, maybe, but on another day I'd catch up to a dozen. And over the years, I've caught all kinds of strange things, in sparrow hawks and a little thing called a firecrest on one occasion. But anyway, so your gardens are very diverse places, and I think a gardener nowadays should regard themselves as managing a nature reserve. And if you manage your garden for biodiversity, that is for not just the flowers, but for the birds, for the insects, for the millipedes, the centipedes, and dare I say it, even for the slugs and snails, and leave a few nettles in the corner and teasels and thistles and things, you can get a very diverse community of insects, birds, and everything else there. So if you do that, you'll be surprised what you will have in your garden and what will breed in your garden. Cleanliness was always said to be next to godliness, but dirt is actually good in some ways, or unruliness is good. If you let the garden go a little bit wilder than most people do, or let part of it go a little bit wilder than most people would allow, you will find that you'll be repaid by the diversity of the creatures that will end up there. Yeah. It's a complicated subject and not everyone will agree, but I'd put the idea out there anyway.
Absolutely, and it comes back to something you said earlier on, Richard, as well, about Bloom being this interesting meeting point between all these kind of places. That maybe it's a case of, obviously there will be some people in the audience, some gardeners in the audience who will favour clean gardening, clean rows, and they don't want any nettles, weeds, or anything that's going to attract in birds or slugs. But obviously, if people are kind of more concerned about the environment and about ecology, they're going to like go down that way. Which supposed brings me to the next question, which is like, is it a case that you've kind of found, for both of you, that people are beginning to realise more and more about the change, about climate change and ecology and its effect on wildlife, and especially its effect on bird populations?
Absolutely. We're certainly finding that, even speaking to people here at Bloom, obviously people who come to Bloom tend to be more attuned to what's happening in their garden and the environment around their homes. So it's often we would use it as a sort of an acid test to what the rest of the population will follow in years to come. Certainly we're finding people saying things like, you know, they're having blue tits nesting earlier in their gardens, or there's problems sometimes with them not finding enough caterpillars. The message there really, I suppose, is that the birds... they're great to study for themselves, they're wonderful to watch, but they're also a very good barometer of what's going on with the environment around you. They're indicator species of the health of the overall environment, because you won't have birds in your garden if the ecosystem there isn't right for them. So to give an example of that, we often get people coming up to the Birdwatch Ireland stand here at Bloom complaining about having a sparrow coming into their garden and catching some of their blue tits or the sparrows on their feeder, when in fact that's actually a compliment to you in the garden. You wouldn't have an apex predator at the top of the food chain like that in your neighbourhood if there wasn't a good population of small birds there to sustain it. So far from being a bad thing for the birds, it's actually an indication that all is going right with the birds in that way. We definitely find as well that there's more and more interest in it. I think people in Ireland are very interested in their gardens and very interested in the creatures that use them. And I suppose this idea of more natural, organic type gardening is catching on more and more. I think it has a very big role to play in conserving these birds. I mean, gardens, private gardens, are one of the biggest groups of habitat we have in Ireland. There's 1.5 million of them across the Republic of Ireland. When you add up that acreage, it adds up to more than all the natural nature reserves and national parks combined. So each of us have a role to play, I think, in that, our own little mini nature reserves.
Okay. There's a kind of civilizing going on. If you look at ourselves, we're around 200,000 years on this planet. Homo sapiens, a creature exactly like us, existed 200,000 years ago. There were hominids earlier than that, but they differed from us a little. Now, of that time, 95% of that time has been spent by our ancestors hunting and gathering. Only in the last 5% did we opt for agriculture, and only in the last 0.5% did we start living in cities. So we have become, we were a wildlife creature, and we have now become a tame, civilized creature. Now, it's interesting that the guard birds are like that. They too are becoming, they're opting to join us in gardens, in living a semi, not a captive life, but a life interacting with us. So the birds, in a sense, the little robins and thrushes and blackbirds, once lived in woodland or on the fringes of woodland. And of course, that's more or less gone most places now. So they have settled to live with us in the suburbs. And the suburbs are enormously rich for birds. We have a huge diversity of little songbirds and pigeons. We even have falcons coming into the city, like the peregrine. We have sparrowhawks coming into the city. So they are following us a little behind into civilization, I always think. So we have to manage and live with them in a civilized manner by managing our gardens and our parks and everything else to encourage them. And I think we're doing that. And people are much better now than they ever were. I've been giving a course in UCD in birds for the last 35 years, I think. It's the longest running course in UCD. And now, I used to always go in, I would always go in and say, well, hands up, who can recognize this bird? And I'd show them a few slides on the first day. In the old days, nobody would recognize a wren or a dunnock or something like that. They might recognize a blue tit, but they'd get confused with a coal tit. Do it now, and you'll have to show them some strange rarity before it stumps them. So times are changing. People are much better informed. Children are much better informed than they were long ago. It's great to see it.
Yeah. And how important did our initiatives like, say, you know, the Dawn Chorus on Money Goes Wild in terms of that, in terms of creating that interest and creating that awareness?
I think it's absolutely vital. I think that what we see through Mooney Goes Wild, and Richard and I obviously work quite a lot on the Dawn Chorus over the years, it gets an enormous listenership, and it's amazing to get that feedback from people. I mean, almost everybody I speak to at Bloom has remembered something from the radio program. I think it's done an amazing amount on a very low budget to bring wildlife into people's homes. As part of my job, I'm lucky enough to get to go to quite a lot of schools to talk to children. And you always meet in schools a lot of children, particularly in primary schools, who are very interested in birds and in wildlife. But they tend to know more about the wildlife of sub-Saharan Africa than they do about the wildlife of their own back garden. And there's a place for that. That's good in a way. But what's happening around our own homes on a micro level is every bit as fascinating. I remember, just blew my mind, thinking about, you know, that we have various ants around our gardens. We have in basic terms, we have black ants and red ants. And the black ants take the young red ants hostage and raise them as slaves. It's happening in your garden under the patio stones. So, you know, every bit as fantastic as what's going on in Africa. But I think think the thing is that we need to foster that. We need to encourage it. And it's something that isn't focused enough on in the curriculum. I mean, it can be a real big issue. I know that certainly we get lots of students who go through the whole school system. They get A's in biology in their leaving cert. They know everything about the anatomy of the earthworm. They know how to dissect a frog. They know how to draw a diagram of a plant cell. They don't know very much at all about predator-prey relationships or how to identify birds or how to actually get practical work in the environmental sector. And I think that's really important. We need to focus more on that. I think that's something that we've done, I suppose, ourselves a disservice in this country too, is that a lot of our decision makers and the politicians who make decisions about our lives, they don't know about this stuff. We find actually that the kids know more than the adults do in this area because they're driven by their own sense of knowledge and desire to find knowledge. It just wasn't taught in schools, and we're lagging behind, and behind other Western European countries too. So that's one thing we need to bring forward, and that's something in Birdwatch Ireland we're very conscious of. We want to make sure that the decision makers of the future, like the one sitting here in the front row, we need to make sure that they're aware of the impact that wildlife has on us and on our well-being and mental health, but also on our environment. We don't expect everyone to become an avid bird watcher, traveling after rare birds around Ireland. We do expect people to have a basic respect and understanding of what it means to our lives, and people who make decisions that affect our lives should always bear that in mind, I think.
There was a film called Ryan's Daughter years ago. And this is very old stuff. Most people here probably have never seen this film. But in it, it's set in Dingle, and in it, the local teacher, who's one of the main characters, takes his pupils out on nature study walks. This is set now at the time of the War of Independence, 1919. And it seemed very strange when I saw this film. My God, teachers in the national school that I went to would not in a thousand years take you out to look at frogs and flowers and things like this. So this must be nonsense. Actually, it wasn't nonsense. It was what was done back at the time before independence. It was part of the curriculum. And she actually remained on the national school curriculum after the formation of the Republic. But it kind of lapsed. It was seen as sort of disloyalty, kind of as a British big house thing, do you see? But now, really? Thanks to Eamon de Butler, Gareth Van Gelder, and particularly Eamon de Butler in the 60s television programs, we have been willing to return this great value of nature, this nature study thing. We brought that back into the schools again, and it's a great change. Television, in a sense, has been the great exponent of conservation in Ireland. It has changed everything, I think. But back in the schools now, we have nature on the curriculum, and my grandchildren do nature in school, which is wonderful.
It's funny what you say there, though, that that bird watching Richard and nature were seen as remnants of British rule. You know that they were seen as disloyal. It's kind of funny to look back now at things like that in history, which probably had an effect, in that a lot of people who were growing up at that time didn't have access to that sort of information when they were in school.
Yes, it was seen. My father used to watch birds, but he always was a little bit shy. I shouldn't be saying this. The poor man, he's dead for many years now, but he was always a bit shy of doing it in front of the neighbours, sort of thing. You know, because it was seen as an odd thing to do, you know, and not quite what a nationalistic male should be doing, sort of thing. But he taught me a lot of the basic birds. He got some of them quite wrong, and it took me years to correct them. But he did his best. I shouldn't be saying bad things about my father. I owe him everything. Anyway, it's just a thought.
Yeah, okay. I suppose let's end with some kind of advice for any newcomers who are interested in kind of taking it up. What advice would you give them? And also, maybe talk a little bit about, we talked about what they can see in their backyard. What about if someone's really serious about bird watching and they want to kind of do something properly? Advise them maybe on a couple of day trips and advise people where's the best spots to go.
Well, I think at this time of the year, what I would really advise anybody with even a passing interest in birds to do is to go and to see one of our seabird colonies. Ireland is home to some of the most spectacular seabird colonies you'll find anywhere in Europe, or indeed in the world. Obviously, the puffins get a lot of attention. We even have puffins here in Dublin. It's something that people don't realise. We have birds like guillemots and razorbills and kittiwakes and gannets. It's absolutely amazing. And these birds, they're in their thousands in the cliffs around Ireland. The Cliffs of Moher is a great place to see them. Ireland's Eye off Dublin, the Salty Islands in West Wexford. Once you see those, you just realize what special treasures we have. So definitely during the summer, I would very much recommend that. Also, what I'd recommend too, obviously I'm here to fly the Birdwatch Ireland flag as well. Birdwatch Ireland has 30 branches around Ireland. And over the course of the year, we hold over 450 free public events, totally free. You can go along at literally anywhere in Ireland and see birds and learn about them. And I think the most important thing to do, and this is really, really crucial, I think, is to enjoy it. People can become very obsessed with trying to put names on things, get very upset with themselves, and they can't identify every creature they see. And that sort of leads to people becoming dispirited and maybe giving up. Forget about that. What happens is just enjoy it. Enjoy birds for the beautiful creatures that they are. And over time, you'll find you absorb more knowledge without realizing it. You just, by osmosis almost, after a year or so of doing this, you'll know more than you ever would just from sitting down reading books. So please, come along to some of those events and activities. Go to some nature reserves. Keep an eye on what's in your back garden. We have a wonderful survey every year called the Garden Bird Survey, where we ask people to keep, over a 13-week period, to keep track of the different species of birds that come in and out of their garden. It becomes really addictive. We find people become just completely obsessed with it and send the data to us. Now, the data we get from that tells us so much about bird populations. But for people too, it focuses the mind in a way that just wouldn't otherwise, because you have a task and a goal to achieve. So I definitely would recommend that. And also, just if anyone wants to stop by here at Bloom, at the Birdwatch Ireland tent, or the Grand Pavilion too, we have a stand there too, get some free posters, ask us some questions, and maybe join as a member. We'd love to have you. And you go to our website, birdwatchireland.ie, for details of reserves and events all over Ireland, and enjoy it.
What would you add to that, Richard?
Well, I would add that the ordinary is often extraordinary. Now, one of the most despised little birds we have around us is the starling. Now, everyone has sort of said, oh, those bloomin' starlings, they eat everything on the bird table and they nest in my eaves and create all kinds of a mess. Now, I think by far the most spectacular bird in Ireland, in a sense, is the starling, because in winter we get a massive influx of them from all over Northern Europe, from as far away as Russia, and they build up into enormous concentrations. They have these roosts. Now, if you keep your ear to the ground, tune into Birdwatch Ireland, Mooney Goes Wild, and contact Birdwatch Ireland, you will find venues where hundreds of thousands of starlings gather into great flocks at dusk, and they fly over you and they shower you in their poo, apart from anything else. But it is a most wonderful experience. Last winter, it was under Albert Bridge in Belfast. I went under Albert Bridge on a boat with Derek Mooney. Several hundred thousand starlings under that bridge roosting. The previous year it was Port Arlington. There was a marvellous roost in Port Arlington. And these are extraordinary spectacles. In winter, you don't have to get up at all hours. You go there at dusk and they gather and they put on this great swirling show. And that is, nothing in nature is quite in the same league as that, I think.
Okay. One last question. I suppose it's to do with kind of birds in the news. How did you react, both of you, like as avid bird watchers, to say last year's stories around like the hungry seagulls and the fact that seagulls were suddenly kind of appearing on city streets, snatching sandwiches from people's hands? It became this. It reminded me of, when I was researching this, it reminded me of one of the few times birds get into the news is when they're seen as a hazard or they're seen as a pest.
Well, I remember there was a lot of furore about it. We got contacted a lot in Birdwatch Ireland by people who were worried about this. And I even found myself with Katrina McFadden from The Mooney Show standing on live on radio coming out of McDonald's with a burger in my hand that I just bought to see if the rogue gull would come down and attack me. Luckily, it didn't. So certainly, sometimes birds like that, yes, they come into contact with people and they affect people's lives. People worry about this. I think there can be a lot of scaremongering about that. It's not the problem it's been made out to be. Part of it is familiarity with humans, but part of it is actually these birds, far from becoming more common, the birds that are involved is a bird called the herring gull, it's actually become much rarer. It's now on the red list in Ireland. It's endangered in this country. The population has declined by more than 90% in the last 20 years. And they're coming into the city not because they're overabundant and losing the run of themselves, it's because the population's in crisis. What's happened is the offshore islands around Dublin Bay, where they would traditionally nest, they've become overrun now with rats and with people and lots of disturbance. These birds have now moved into urban islands. So instead of being surrounded by water, they're surrounded by traffic on the rooftops. What they're doing in many cases is they're being territorial. They're protecting their young and their eggs. But also what they're doing too is they've learned now to associate humans with food. And that can be a problem too. When creatures, any wild creature becomes less wild, when it sees humans as an easy meal ticket, that can lead to problems. Now, if it's a bird like a robin or a blue tit that isn't strong enough to cause you any problems, there's nothing it can do about it. But when it's a bird like a gull, which is quite intimidating and has has a seriously sharp beak, yeah, that can be a problem. Usually man is at the cause of these problems. We're cause them. But the thing is as well, when we see people then calling for these birds to be culled and destroyed, that can be a disaster for the population because they really are in difficulty.
Last word to you, Richard.
Yes, I think it's always a rogue individual that does this kind of thing. In our society, most people are very good and decent and all the rest, but there is the odd one that misbehaves, and some misbehave in an extraordinarily awful fashion. The same is true with wild things. Most 99.99% of creatures will do you no harm. Even wolves, most maligned of animals, are practically unknown ever to attack anybody. So the gull that does this snatching and gets a bit uppity is an individual that has found this a way of getting food, and it is just one in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. So it doesn't mean that you should damn all gulls because one is bad.
Okay, exactly. Excellent. Okay, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you to Niall, and thank you to Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you, James.
Many thanks to Niall and Richard for taking the time to join us at Banter, and thanks to Rosa Borby and her team for all their help with Banter at Bloom. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can also check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, plus you can listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. Bloom 2016 takes place at the Phoenix Park Dublin from June 2nd to 6th, and keep an eye on bloominthepark.com for more information. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.